Patsy with a Z. Welcome to Joy on Paper, a program for writers and those who dream of writing, and for everyone who wants to know the story behind the book. Coming to you from glorious Clearwater, Florida, the perfect place for writers to write and readers to enjoy a good book. And I am so happy to welcome back again Bill Larson, our legal eagle, to talk about intellectual property and some other things that have to do with the law, because some of you people out there, some of you writers, are getting yourself in trouble. And so I'm so happy to say hi, Bill. How are you?
Fine, thank you. Good morning.
Good morning. Okay, well, just what we need. You know, I have been having so many really New York Times best-selling authors on the program lately, and I would say that about one quarter of them are lawyers, or in their previous life. Some of them say they are recovering lawyers, but they have written bestsellers. So, you know, I expect maybe one day, you know, you will decide to write your own bestseller. How about that?
I am. I'm already working on it.
Okay. See, I knew it. Because the law is a good training ground for writers. Because you learn discipline.
It is. That's all we do.
You learn discipline.
That's all we do is write.
You write and write, and you have the discipline that's needed for an author to be successful. So I'm looking forward to that day. But meanwhile, you can help some of my listeners here who have, oh gosh, you know, some of them have a little bit
excellent
too.
Excellent question. Yeah, great questions coming in.
Yeah, a little bit too much spare time, perhaps, because some of them are getting themselves in trouble. As a matter of fact, one of my listeners actually closed down her Facebook page because she got herself in trouble. And that's not good for a writer, because there aren't very many ways to connect with readers today. But one of the questions, I like this question because, you know, it's very relevant and something that people don't think about. Writers, you know, they will buy a book cover, they will hire an illustrator, perhaps over the internet or sometimes from a service like Fiverr, and they'll buy it and they'll think that that's it, that's theirs forever and ever, and they can do anything they want. So I have a listener who wants to use, actually she wants to use part of the illustration, a part that she likes. I won't say what animal, but it has an animal on it that's relevant to her storyline. And she wants to crop it and put it on T-shirts. And not just that, she wants also to do it in different versions, like not just black and white, but, you know, like do it in pink, do it in red, whatever. Can she do that?
All right. Well, it all depends on who owns the copyright. And the person who owns the copyright is the person who has the right to make additional copies of that, either on T-shirts or for other books or for any kind of products. So it would all depend on whether or not the author signed a contract with the illustrator. And in the contract, there was an assignment clause, a copyright assignment clause. If you pay somebody, an illustrator, for example, to do a cover for you, and let's say $100, and they provide you that illustration, you are entitled for your $100 that you paid to use that illustration on this one item, which is a book in this case, but nothing else. The only way you can get the rights to use that over and over and over again is if you have a contract with the illustrator that assigns the copyright, the legal right to create copies. And if you don't have that, then the answer is no, you don't have the right to reuse it.
Well, and this is where the problem arises, because, you know, sometimes when they buy something, like I know that you've looked at Fiverr quite a few times, you have a simple form there you fill in, and so many writers assume that they are getting everything with that. And this this can really create a problem. Let's talk a little bit about the Obama poster and how that came about.
Right. So, but that also has, there's a complex mix of art and copyright in there. There's also mixes of the fact that he's a politician, okay? And so that kind of loosens up the rules. But in most cases, what the authors have to remember is that when you're going to get involved with anybody, whether it's an editor or an illustrator or a graphic artist or co-writer, whatever it's going to be, you have to nail down who is the owner of the copyright. And it's really just one sentence. In this case, we would have the illustrator would sign a contract where it said, in addition to the $100, that the illustrator assigns all right title and interest to the copyright to the author. That one sentence, that's it. You win. That's the one sentence you need. Those are the magic words that you need. So now the author owns the copyright. Once the author owns the copyright, she, he can do anything they want with that image, with that graphic art, whatever that may be, photograph, sculpture, whatever it is. But without the magic words of assignment of copyright, those three magic words, then the illustrator or the artist retains the copyright and retains the right to continue to sell the image or the photograph or the sculpture and not the author. And this happens over and over and over again. The authors have to be very careful that there's a copyright assignment clause in all of their contracts with anybody they deal with concerning their books.
And this is, it can turn out to be a big problem because the young woman I'm talking about who wrote me, you know, and said, you know, what can I do now? She actually bought an illustration on Fiverr. And that was like 3 years ago, and she's been selling the book, and she had so many comments. People said, oh, I really like that cover. Can you, you know, I'd really like, you know, something. And so it occurred to her after it's been 3 years now, that she wanted to do this. And she realized she could take quotes from her book. She wanted to put quotes from her book and the illustration or parts of the illustration.
Right.
And so she went to, you know, at the time she wasn't even thinking about what she signed. But she went to Fiverr. And now Fiverr, all she knew about the person was that it was somebody in Bangladesh, by the way, is no longer on Fiverr. She has no way, no idea how to connect to this person. She tried to do a Google search in Bangladesh for this, you know, this illustrator. We don't. She doesn't even know if the illustrator, that's the real name, you know. So now what does she do?
Well, you have to go back and look at the original contract, whatever it was. There was some kind of contract that was signed. It was either an acceptance by clicking on a box or some kind of wording in there. Okay. If there's no transfer of the copyright, okay, no explicit transfer of the copyright using the magic words, then she doesn't own the copyright in it. Now the question is, who does? Well, maybe that person can never be found. But the problem is that if she is not the owner of the copyright by assignment, then she's also prohibited from filing a copyright application and registering it in her name. However, on the other side, she can use the art for the purposes of the trademark. That you don't need a copyright assignment for because that's a trademark. So anybody can take an image, as long as it's not a copyright issue, and use it as a trademark. So she's free to use that picture on shirts and stuff and quotes from her books, but she needs to go back, he or she needs to go back and look at the language of the contract when the money was paid and the art was done 3 years ago to see what it says. And hopefully somewhere in there it says you get all right title and interest of the copyright. If so, you're good to go. You don't have to do anything else. You can file your copyright application as an assignee. You can file trademark applications and for shirts and all for on all these images. But it all depends on the language in that original agreement.
Well, because she is an up-and-coming author. I think she's, you know, going to, she's very good. So she thinks she's going to be famous, and I think perhaps she's going to be famous. And so she was thinking that, well, will somebody come after me? And what happens if, for example, she uses this, you know, this image, and whoever it is in Bangladesh or wherever sees it and says, gee, that, you know, now it's on things that are printed, you know, in China and, you know, the hundreds of thousands, and comes back to her. Is there a fine involved? What would she do then?
Well, theoretically, it's copyright infringement. So if the illustrator filed a copyright application and registered the work, then the illustrator could file a legal action for copyright infringement for the uses above and beyond what was in the agreement, for instance, on the cover of the book. So those other derivative type of uses, like putting it on shirts or whatever, on posters or whatever you're going to do. So you have to go back to the language of your original agreement, and hopefully it says that the author received all right, title, and interest in the copyright. If that's true, the author needs to file a copyright application right away and register it as the assignee. In other words, not as the author, but the assignee. And part of it is you need to have the name of the actual author, or in the case of if it's a company, in the name of the company who hires authors, and that's the information that has to go in your copyright application. So authors need to be aware of this when they're getting involved with illustrators or other folks when they're getting started, to make sure that their contracts cover all of the copyrights and derivative rights and downstream rights, so that in the event they become very famous, you know, that's when they come out of the woodwork.
Exactly.
You know, if you never become famous, yeah, it's not until you really start making millions, and then somebody says, hey, that's mine, and then they talk to a lawyer, and that lawyer says, hey, you got a pretty good case, let's file a lawsuit, and then they come after you for your money.
Well, that's what happened with the Obama photo.
That's what happened with the Obama photo. There's hundreds of cases out there where authors and illustrators and others have come after each other for either plagiarism or for misuse. And all of this can be cleaned up, and there'll be no problem if you're just careful when you get started and have the right contracts. Talk to a copyright lawyer.
Exactly.
Make sure that the agreements that you're signing before you buy anything, before you pay anything, do any work off the internet or download anything off the internet, talk to a copyright lawyer so you make sure your rights are covered, because once they're gone forever.
And Bill Larson of Larson & Larson is the perfect intellectual property lawyer that anyone can get, and because you are a member of Ape Law, right?
Yeah, that's a big association of patent, trademark, and copyright lawyers. The biggest in it's worldwide. That's a very good other asset for our listeners. It's AIPLA.org, American Intellectual Property Law Association.org. And if you go on there, you'll see there's thousands and thousands of lawyers from around the world that do every flavor of intellectual property law. So you have a selection. You can call up any one of those. So maybe if you're in a foreign country or you're in a different state, you know, we're down here on the Gulf of Mexico, maybe you want somebody closer to you, you can find a copyright lawyer close to where you live and go get an appointment. And yes, you know, the downside is you're going to have to pay some money. Okay.
Uh-huh.
Lawyers aren't free. Okay. And so if lawyers were free, everybody would use lawyers all the time, and lawyers wouldn't have any air to breathe.
That's it. Exactly.
Okay.
I know it.
Okay. But people don't like to use lawyers, and they're like, well, it's going to cost me $200. And they skip that step, and then it comes back to haunt you. And I'm not trying to beat my old drum here and trying to get people to pour in here to hire me. But all I'm saying is this is you've got to take the proper legal precautions when you're getting started, because once gone, they're gone forever, and you can't get back. And that's how people get really hurt legally later on when they become popular.
And you don't want really bad nightmares for 30 years, as I have had, because I thought I didn't need a lawyer when I started. And boy, did I learn a very, very expensive lesson. And
yes.
So and I will just remind everybody, do not use real estate. Do not use a tax lawyer. And definitely do not use a lawyer who has just come out of law school, because you're going to get in trouble. And that's what happened to me 30 years ago. And I still have every once in a while a really bad nightmare about that.
Right. So if you're buying and selling a building or a house, you don't call a copyright lawyer, you call a real estate lawyer. If you're getting a divorce, you call a divorce lawyer. If you've got a criminal problem, you call a criminal lawyer. You know, lawyers, it's not like the old days where lawyers did everything. If you walked
you
in
can.
The door, a lawyer could do anything. Now everything's specialized because the law has grown so much. So everybody has these little specialties, okay? So for me, it's intellectual property. But for, you know, all of my associate lawyers that I have and all my friends, everybody has a different flavor of what they practice in the law. Maybe personal injury, it may be criminal law, it may be immigration, anything you can think of. And everybody specializes these days because it's impossible to know all the law anymore. And you can find these specialists very easy. Go on Google or go to AIPLA or go to lawyers.com or any of those things and find a lawyer Close to, and if you can, get a face-to-face meeting. I believe face-to-face meetings are better than email meetings, but you can Zoom.
If you're wearing a mask, a face-to-face meeting is still pretty good because you can look people in the eye. And another of my listeners wrote another question for you, and here is a difficult one. She signed with an agent. I mean, an agent actually, you know, she sent out query letters. An agent came back to her, said, you know, I really like this book. I think it has great possibilities, you know, and she signed a contract with her. They started working, as you do with, people don't realize that, you know, the agents do not present a book to a publisher until they think the publisher, you know, it's in the right shape for a publisher to accept it. So she was working.
Same as the music industry.
Exactly.
Yep.
So she's working.
It's like
that
in every industry.
She's working for about 4 or 5 months over, you know, time. The agent would send her ideas and she was making some changes, you know, just beefing it up a little bit here, beefing it up. More descriptions, perhaps. But then it got to a point where the agent said, well, I don't think you can say, your character can say that. And she said, yeah, but that's my character. You know, it's something not politically correct, for sure, not politically correct. Mm-hmm. She said, that's my character. He's not politically correct. He's a really stupid idiot, and I want to show that he, you know. And then the agent started saying, well, and she found a few other things that she thought were inappropriate in this day and age. You can't say these things. And so now the writer is saying, well, what am I going to do? I can't change this. This is how my characters talk. You know, sometimes characters take over a writer's mind. You see them, you hear them in your head. And her point is that she was making the characters talk the way, if you didn't like what they were saying, well, she didn't want you to like the character. So now what did she do? The agent is adamant that she has to take certain words, certain phrases, certain political comments, I mean, really down to even some gender comments out. And she said, now what am I going to write? You know what? It doesn't make sense. What does she do?
Well, this is a contract dispute. Okay, so when this author engaged the agent to assist with the book, there was a contract. Whether the author had a agency lawyer or a copyright lawyer review the contract to explain all of the things that were in there, I don't know.
No, she didn't.
But
she thought the agent is a New York City top agent, and she signed that thing without even. I don't think she actually read it. She was so excited.
Okay. So now we don't know what's in it. So now we have to go out, we have to go back and we have to pull that contract out and see what the terms are. The terms may say that the agent has the right to veto certain things against the author's wishes, or the contract, if it was written properly, if I was working on it, I would have had that the author had the sole discretion to put anything they wanted in there, and if the agent didn't like it, then the agent doesn't have to continue with the book. But it all depends on the contract that was signed. So that contract has to be pulled out and picked over by a lawyer to see what her rights are. It may be that the author, he or she, has the sole discretion to make all the decisions on the finality of the book, including all of the content and stuff that's not politically correct. And it's part of the free speech. You're allowed to do it. But if the agent reserved the right to make the final call, then the author's stuck. The agent has the right to make the final call. But it's whatever the contract says.
Oh, wow. And so
you gotta pull that contract out and read it very carefully and see who has the final say.
Wow, she's in a pickle then, I think, because it's one of these, you know, 15% to the agent. If she pulls out, I don't know. She really needs help.
Well,
it's definitely.
Well, she needs to get the contract, take it to a lawyer, pick through it, have the lawyer explain what all the provisions mean. The pros and cons of your contract, and then you will know where you are. But until you go and get the advice of an attorney who can explain all the legalese in there, you don't know. You're just, you know, you're just wandering in the desert. So, you know, you've got to get the contract out, call a lawyer, go see a lawyer, have the lawyer look over the contract and explain what it means and ask your questions and find out where you are. And then once you know where you are, then you can take action. But you can't just blindly take action when you don't know what it means. That's how you get in trouble.
Well, that's why I'm telling everybody, all my listeners, never, ever sign, just like you would not sign a contract for a house without a lawyer or anything.
Title agent.
A title agent. Never sign a contract without a lawyer, and never send an email saying, oh, yeah, I accept this offer without, you know, it's, you have to have a lawyer. You can't sign anything without a lawyer. And just because a publisher or an agent is famous and they have a really great lawyer doesn't mean that that really great lawyer is going to look out for your interests, right?
No, because the lawyers can't represent both sides on a contract.
Exactly.
The lawyer can only represent one individual at a time. So both sides have to have their own lawyers. And that's what makes everything fair, because the lawyer on one side writes it in favor of his client, and the lawyer on the other side says, well, I want to change this in favor of my client. And that's the negotiation process that we go through when we're doing contracts like this. You give a little, you take a little, and then you come out in the middle and you sign the agreement. But if you just blindly sign, then and you don't know what it means, then there's no way to answer the question without reviewing the contract. The author needs to go to a lawyer with the contract and have it explained what
well,
it means.
Well, you know, Bill, it was a great conversation today. We've answered two very important questions and covered some other things that I think will open people's eyes, and they will think about things before they say things or before they sign things. Mm-hmm. And thank you so much. You are our resident legal eagle. How can people contact you?
The best is LarsonPatentLaw.com. They can go to our website, and we have the email submissions there. If you want to ask me questions, just send me an email, and I'll try to help you. And if you need contracts or you need copyright applications or you just want to ask a question, just send me an email on my website, LarsonPatentLaw.com, and I'll be glad to help any of our listeners.
Well, Bill Larson, I think you are fantastic. I hope you're staying safe out there. And we really, really appreciate all your advice. And we'll talk to you next month, okay?
Thank you for having me.
Okay. Bye-bye now, Bill.
Bye-bye.
Now we'll have some commercials really quickly, and then I'm coming back with something really great.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
Do you dread being called on to speak at meetings or family functions? Have you envied those who can sway an audience with well-chosen words? Do you know that people who speak well earn more money, earn more rewarding careers? Gain the confidence to master any speaking situation. Toastmasters will allow you to find your voice. Go to toastmasters.org to locate the club nearest you.
Are you an author, an artist, an inventor? Then you need to protect your valuable intellectual property. You need Larson & Larson. We have the experience and knowledge to help you with all of your legal needs, from processing trademark, copyright, or patent applications, to negotiating licensing agreements and handling litigation. The attorneys at Larson & Larson in Largo, Florida, can help protect you. Call us today for a no-cost consultation at 727-546-0660 or visit our website at LarsonPatentLaw.com.
Have you ever faced disaster? The Red Cross is always there for you. The Red Cross responds to a call for help every 8 seconds. They have never turned anyone down. Now they need your financial support so that they can be ready to help you when the need arises. Donate online at redcross.org. Thank you.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
This is Patsy with a Z, and I am back with my very special guest today, Nicholas Guy Smith. I love this man. I have spent many hours having him whisper in my ear. I think at least 200 hours I have spent with Nick. Hi, Nick.
Hi, hope you can hear me nice and clearly. Lovely to hear your voice.
Oh, yes. Well, it's your voice. It's your voice that I love. And for all of my listeners, of course, they know you as that voice because you are so amazing. An award-winning, you know, narrator. I first discovered you with A Gentleman in Moscow, which I listened to over and over and over so many times. I will just put it on, and I'm calm, relaxed when I listen to your voice. And then, of course, also the award-winning The Remains of the Day, which you read so beautifully. It's just
thank you.
A joy to have you back here on Joy on Paper today.
Well, thank you very much. And those two books that you mentioned are real highlights for me. They're all wonderful experiences. Remains of the Day, particularly, was extremely personal and enjoyable. I recommend it to anyone.
Well,
that one. Beautiful book.
But both of them are just fantastic.
Yeah.
And but your voice is so great that you are the only person who could make World Economic Forum founder, executive chairman Klaus Schwab's book, The Fourth Industrial Revolution. Sounds
right.
Sexy. I mean, I can listen to that one for hours. So,
some of those books are quite dry. They definitely are. Okay. And I tend to do quite a few nonfiction. So when I get a fiction book, I'm very excited because I can get into the characters.
Well, and you do. Now, you know, since really the Renaissance movement, when Geoffrey Chaucer worked to modernize the English language, all the way down through the fables of J.R.R. Tolkien, really the vision of the British poet has been a shining light in the world of literature. And one of those lights, one of the brightest lights for me, is John Keats. And the reason I invited you to be on the program today is because February 23rd was the 200th anniversary of the death of John Keats. And whilst I was on my first honeymoon in Italy, my husband and I did a grand tour of Italy. We started at the top and went all the way down to the bottom, to Brindisi. So one of the stops, of course, was Rome. And there I persuaded my husband, when newlyweds, that was my first honeymoon. I had three honeymoons, but I married the same guy three times, so I'll explain that one day. Anyway, I persuaded him to take me to a cemetery, and he thought that's he didn't know. I mean, he you know, we were in love, but he didn't know my obsession with books. So there I go to the cemetery, and he takes me to, I wanted to go to the grave of John Keats. And I had always been really touched by what he wanted written on his grave. And so when I get there and I read it, I started crying, and I am crying and crying. And my husband is not, you know, English was not his native language, so he didn't know Keats at all, and had never read anything by John Keats. And I'm crying and crying, and he's like, who did I marry here? You know. And so then I read to him parts of John Keats' work. And so that's what I wanted you to read today. Let's read from book two of John Keats. And I know that you've prepared that. So do you want to go ahead?
Yeah, I have. And while you were talking, I looked up online what is written on the gravestone. Here lies one whose name was writ in water. Right?
Yes.
That's what... what you read.
He died thinking that he would be in eternal obscurity, that no one would ever know about him, no one would ever care about his work. And that made me so sad, and I've always sort of held that, not to have your name written in water. And he thought he was going to be, but of course people did eventually recognize. And he was actually, you know, he was progressive. He was... he was injured really by some very harsh criticism of his work, and he died so with this idea in his head, and it broke my heart to read that. So what are you going to read for us?
I'm going to read part of book two, where Endymion ventures into the underworld in search of his love. It's about 8 minutes, so here we go. O sovereign power of love, O grief, O balm, all records saving thine come cool and calm and shadowy through the mist of past years. For others, good or bad, hatred and tears have become indolent. But touching thine, one sigh doth echo, one poor sob doth pine, one kiss brings honey dew from buried days. The woes of Troy, towers smothering over their blaze, stiff holden shields, far-piercing spears, keen blades struggling and blood and shrieks, all dimly fades into some backward corner of the brain. Yet in our very souls we feel amain the close of Troilus and Cressid sweet. Hence pageant history, hence gilded cheat, swart planet in the universe of deeds, wide sea that one continuous murmur breeds along the pebbled shore of memory. Many old rotten timbered boats there be upon thy vaporous bosom, magnified to goodly vessels. Many a sail of pride and golden keeled is left unlaunched and dry. But wherefore this? What care though owl did fly about the great Athenian admiral's mast? What care though striding Alexander passed the Indus with his Macedonian numbers? Though old Ulysses tortured from his slumbers the glutted Cyclops, what care? Juliet, leaning amid her window flowers, sighing, weaning tenderly her fancy from its maiden snow, doth more avail than these. The silver flow of heroes' tears, the swoon of Imogen, fair Pastorella in the bandit's den, are things to brood on with more ardency than the death day of empires. Fearfully must such conviction come upon his head, who, thus far discontent, has dared to tread without one muse's smile or kind behest the path of love and poesy. But rest, in chafing restlessness, is yet more drearer than to be crushed in striving to uprear love's standard on the battlements of song. So once more days and nights aid me along like legion soldiers. Brain-sick shepherd prince, what promise hast thou faithful guarded since the day of sacrifice? Or have new sorrows come with a constant dawn upon thy morrows? Alas, 'tis his old grief. For many days has he been wandering in uncertain ways through wilderness and woods of mossed oaks, counting his woe-worn minutes by the strokes of the lone woodcutter, and listening still, hour after hour, to each lush-leaved rill. Now he is sitting by a shady spring, and elbow deep with feverous fingering stems the upbursting cold. A wild rose tree pavilions him in bloom, and he doth see a bud which snares his fancy. Lo, but now he plucks it, dips its stalk in the water. How it swells, it buds, it flowers beneath his sight, and in the middle there is softly piped a golden butterfly, upon whose wings there must be surely caricate strange things, for with wide eye he wonders and smiles oft. Lightly this little herald flew aloft, followed by glad Endymion's clasped hands. Onward it flies. From languor's sullen bands his limbs are loosed, and eager on he hies, dazzled to trace it in the sunny skies. It seemed he flew, the way so easy was, and like a newborn spirit did he pass through the green evening quiet in the sun, over many a heath, through many a woodland dun, through buried paths where sleepy twilight dreams the summertime away. One track unseems a wooden cleft, and far away the blue of ocean fades upon him. Then anew he sinks adown a solitary glen, where there was never sound of mortal men, saving perhaps some snow-light cadences melting to silence, when upon the breeze some holy bark let forth an anthem sweet to cheer itself to Delphi. Still his feet went swift beneath the merry-winged guide, until it reached a splashing fountain's side that, near a cavern's mouth, forever poured unto the temperate air. Then high it soared, and downward suddenly began to dip, as if athirst with so much toil 'twould sip the crystal spout head. So it did, with touch most delicate, as though afraid to smutch even with mealy gold the waters clear. But at that very touch, to disappear so fairy quick was strange. Bewildered, Endymion sought around and shook each bed of covert flowers in vain, and then he flung himself along the grass. What gentle tongue, what whisperer disturbed his gloomy rest? It was a nymph, uprisen to the breast in the fountain's pebbly margin, and she stood among lilies like the youngest of the brood. To him, her dripping hand she softly kissed, and anxiously began to plait and twist her ringlets round her fingers, saying, "Youth, too long, alas, hast thou starved on the ruth, the bitterness of love. Too long indeed, seeing thou art so gentle. Could I weed thy soul of care, by heavens, I would offer all the bright riches of my crystal coffer to Aphrodite. All my clear-eyed fish, golden or rainbow-sided or purplish, vermilion-tailed or finned with silvery gauze, yea, all my veined pebble floor that draws a virgin light to the deep, my grotto sands tawny in gold, ooze slowly from far lands by my diligent springs, my level lilies, shells, my charming rod, my potent river spells. Yes, everything, even to the pearly cup Meander gave me, for I bubbled up to fainting creatures in a desert wild. But woe is me, I am but as a child to gladden thee, and all I dare to say is that I pity thee, that on this day I've been thy guide, that thou must wander far in other regions, past the scanty bar to mortal steps, before thou canst be taken from every wasting sigh, from every pain, into the gentle bosom of thy love. Why it is thus, one knows in heaven above, but a poor naiad I guess not. Farewell, I have a ditty for my hollow cell."
Oh, wow.
So there's that, with meeting up with the nymph. And then I think you wanted me to read some lines from book one.
Yes, the people will be more familiar with this, just the first few lines.
Here we go. Certainly the first line I'll be familiar with. "A thing of beauty is a joy forever. Its loveliness increases. It will never pass into nothingness, but still will keep a bower quiet for us, and a sleep full of sweet dreams, and health, and quiet breathing. Therefore, on every morrow, are we wreathing a flowery band to bind us to the earth, spite of despondence, of the inhuman dearth of noble natures, of the gloomy days."
Well, you know, I I'm so grateful that you came on the program today to read that, because first, of course, it reminds me of my wonderful, wonderful husband, and how actually, as a result of the reading that poem, the book two part, he did buy me a golden butterfly. So,
oh, wonderful.
Yeah, so I have that still. Now, it leads us to a poet that you love and know very well, because T.S. Eliot actually did, in 1933, he did a lecture about John Keats when he was at Harvard.
Right.
And I know that you know a great deal about Eliot. So tell us what your influence and how you came to write about him and what you want to read for us today.
Yeah, I was a student at Cambridge University, and I was doing a Master of Philosophy in Theology. And my first degree was in English, and my supervisor said, you have to write a thesis, and I know that you're interested in T.S. Eliot, so why don't you write about the theological implications of Eliot's poem, The Four Quartets, and that's what I did. And my supervisor was Rowan Williams, Dr. Rowan Williams, who actually became the Archbishop of Canterbury a few years ago. And I actually did a performance at the college. It was an adaptation of The Wasteland with, I think, five other actors, and that was quite successful, where we basically read the entire poem and acted out certain portions. But my focus was Four Quartets. And as far as I have actually two segments, one from the Four Quartets and one from The Wasteland. The Wasteland is much more approachable and, for me, easy to understand. T.S. Eliot said that poetry communicates, good poetry communicates before it is understood. And certainly with the Four Quartets, some of that stuff is really tough to comprehend, but you get a feel for it. So I can give you a little bit of Burnt Norton Part 2, and I can give you a little bit of A Game of Chess, which is part of The Wasteland Part 2.
Okay, that's perfect.
So, and this is to introduce the Four Quartets, this segment. Rowan Williams said that Four Quartets was one of the most religious poems that he'd ever read, and the word God is not mentioned once. And in this segment, Eliot's talking about the still point of the turning world, which is basically the eternal present moment. It's that moment that is outside of time, although it's in time. It's sort of paradoxical. It's a moment where you are communicating, or where you are one with the eternal mystery, if you want to call it God. So here we go. That's my interpretation. I'm sure other people would think differently. So this is part two, the opening of Burnt Norton. At the still point of the turning world, neither flesh nor fleshless, neither from nor towards, at the still point, there the dances, but neither arrest nor movement, and do not call it fixity, where past and future are gathered, neither movement from nor towards, neither ascent nor decline. Except for the point, the still point, there would be no dance, and there is only the dance. I can only say there we have been, but I cannot say where, and I cannot say how long, for that is to place it in time. The inner freedom from the practical desire, the release from action and suffering, release from the inner and the outer compulsion, yet surrounded by a grace of sense, a white light still and moving, erbang without motion, concentration without elimination, both a new world and the old made explicit, understood in the completion of its partial ecstasy, the resolution of its partial horror. Yet the enchainment of past and future, woven in the weakness of the changing body, protects mankind from heaven and damnation, which flesh cannot endure. So that's a little bit about the still point of the turning world. And the next piece is a game of chess. I just love the way that the language is so eloquent and beautiful, and there's a little bit of dialogue here with characters, so I thought that would be good. So this is just the first part. The chair she sat in, like a burnished throne, glowed on the marble, where the glass held up by standards wrought with fruited vines, from which a golden cupidon peeked out. Another hid his eyes behind his wing, doubled the flames of seven-branch candelabra, reflecting light upon the table as the glitter of her jewels rose to meet it, from satin cases poured in rich profusion. In vials of ivory and colored glass, unstoppered, lurked her strange synthetic perfumes, unguent, powdered or liquid, troubled, confused, and drowned the scents in odors. Stirred by the air that freshened from the window, these ascended in fattening the prolonged candle flames, flung their smoke into the laquaria, stirring the pattern on the coffered ceiling. Huge seawood fed with copper burned green and orange, framed by the colored stone, in which sat light a carved dolphin swam. Above the antique mantle was displayed, as though a window gave upon the sylvan scene the change of Philomel, by the barbarous king so rudely forced. Yet there the nightingale filled all the desert with inviolable voice, and still she cried, and still the world pursues, jug, jug, to dirty ears. And othered withered stumps of time were told upon the walls, staring forms leaned out, leaning, hushing the room enclosed. Footsteps shuffled on the stair, under the firelight, under the brush, her hair spread out in fiery points, glowed into words, then would be savagely still. My nerves are bad tonight. Yes, bad. Stay with me. Speak to me. Why do you never speak? Speak. What are you thinking of? What thinking? What? I never know what you are thinking. Think. I think we are in Rat's Alley, where the dead men lost their bones. What is that noise? The wind under the door. What is that noise now? What is the wind doing? Nothing again. Nothing. Do you know nothing? Do you see nothing? Do you remember nothing? I remember those are pearls that were his eyes. Are you alive or not? Is there nothing in your head? But, oh, that Shakespearean rag. It's so elegant, so intelligent. What shall I do now? What shall I do? I shall rush out as I am and walk the street with my hair down so. What shall we do tomorrow? What shall we ever do? The hot water at 10. And if it rains, a close car at 4. And we shall play a game of chess, pressing Lidler's eyes and waiting for a knock upon the door. So, and that's that. Oh, very dramatic.
Very dramatic. And, of course, beautifully, beautifully narrated by you. You know, Nick, it is really an honor to know you and to, you know, you, as I mentioned to you before, I got more emails from people after they listened to you the first time you were on and reading A Gentleman in Moscow. And it's right. Really a thrill. People, you know, as children, if we're lucky, we have parents who read to us, and that is there in our hearts. And when we have somebody like you now reading to us, and it's really a comfort, and it's an absolute joy to listen to your voice.
Well, thank you, and thank you for what you said about A Gentleman in Moscow. I know that was a very popular book, and it's my favorite. I mean, it's the best thing that I've ever done, so I recommend that one. Thank you. Well, thank you for giving me time on your show.
Well, it's been a joy to talk to you, and it's always a joy to think about you and to listen to you, and I do it constantly. So, again...
Well, that's very sweet.
People can read more about you. You have a website. It's called thatvoice.net, and people can learn more about you. And, of course, on Audible, all they have to do is type in your name, and a whole dozens of books come up. And they can hear your voice. And as I said, you could read anything. You could read the telephone book, and I would listen to it. I know it would be a thrill. Again, Nick, thank you. Thank you so much for putting joy into my life today.
Thank you. Take good care. Until the next time.
Okay, you too. Bye-bye now. Nicholas Guy Smith, what a great narrator. Bye-bye now. Oh, well. That brought me back to that first... that first honeymoon of mine. And it was with my husband of three... I married him three times. Just to make sure, each time I said, let's get married again. So we got married in three different countries, three different times, and I got three honeymoons out of it. And because I read that poem to him at right there, sitting on a bench near John Keats' grave in Rome, he bought me a golden butterfly, too. So you never know what poetry can lead to. It is a lot of fun. It is a great thing for you. All of you, one of course, my listeners and somebody who's been on the program, J.S. Lamb, writes simple little poems. They're not all simple little. You know, that's a beautiful thing about poetry. John Keats, one of the things that he always said was that he thought poetry should be like leaves falling off a tree, just natural. And that's what, you know, poetry can do for you. As a writer, you learn so much about writing. You learn so much about words. J.S. Lamb's poems are like that. They seem so simple. You think that he's just sitting there one day and that just falls like a leaf off of a tree. And they're all delightful. And I will play some over the next month, some more of them, because I love his simple poems. And I mean that in the nicest way. And really, poetry will help you become a greater writer because it opens your mind. So remember, one of the things I always say to you is one of the joys of life is to see your words on paper or to hear them spoken in an audible book, or if you're very, very lucky, to hear those magic words, lights, camera, action, and your book will be turned into a major motion picture, streaming video, or perhaps a series on the Hallmark Channel like I am hoping for Carol J. Perry, and I am so excited. Today, I got her newest book called See Something by Carol J. Perry, and she's going to be here May 25th to talk about it. And you can write, just start right now. Just sit down and write. And meanwhile, say something nice to somebody. I will say something nice to Big Ed in the control room, and he's nodding his head, and he's saluting me, so I can get out of here. Once Ed salutes me, I am out of here. And I hope that you all have a wonderful weekend. Read some poetry. Check out John Keats. It will expand your mind. Bye-bye now.